From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. On this week's show, is it the end for Twinkies and Ding Dongs? Hostess brand is shutting down.
Well, you know what? Start all over. Do what we can do. We're not part of the 1%. You know, we're still part of the 99%. We can make it.
And a 91-year-old Navajo code talker gets his college degree.
In 1968, he had us come into the living room and he told us, he said, this is actually what I did. But we didn't understand exactly how important it was at the time.
Plus, a KU researcher explores the question, are we addicted to texting?
We think people think these are addictive devices, not because people can't make choices about them, but simply because the choice has to be made fast.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
The Hostess Company, with 200 workers at its Lenexa plant, announced Friday morning it would make good on its promise to shut its doors if workers in at least a dozen of its 33 plants didn't return to work. The company, whose Twinkies, Ding Dongs, and Wonder Bread are icons in the history of the American diet, has been losing money for years as that diet shifted toward healthier food choices. Employees with the Lenexa Bakers, Confectioners, Tobacco Workers, and Mill Grainers International were among the first to walk out. As KCUR's Laura Ziegler reports, the Bakers Union said concessions in the most recent round of contract negotiations were simply unacceptable.
In its official statement released Friday morning, Hostess CEO Gregory Rayburn said, quote, "We deeply regret the necessity of today's decision, but we do not have the financial resources to weather an extended nationwide strike." In an interview on Thursday, Hostess spokesman Lance Inyon told me the company had been struggling to make a profit since declaring bankruptcy the first time in 2004. And again last January. Hostess lost more than $300 million last year. Cuts, he said, were essential. Inyon said the company negotiated for 18 months with both the Teamsters and the Bakers Union. The Teamsters eventually accepted the contract. The Bakers did not. Inyon said it was the best the company could do.
We know these concessions are tough. They're difficult. But we think they give the company a chance to exit Chapter 11 and finally do better. And if the company does better, all of our union employees will share in that because they're going to own a quarter of the company.
What he's referring to is a provision in the contract that would have given workers a 25% stake in the company's equity, as well as two seats on the board of directors. But for the Bakers, it was the rest of the contract that was unacceptable. The 8% pay cut, reduction in pension payments, and dramatic decreases to the employee health care plan. On the picket line across from the Lenexa Hostess plant the night before last week's announcement, James Jones, who works on the production line, said the workers can't afford to give any more.
You know, over the years, we took so many concessions starting at 2004. We had our first bankruptcy. It was over with in 2008. They started all over again in 2009, a second bankruptcy. You know, there's only so much that we can really give right now. I mean, we don't have anything else to give. Our wages went down.
Some honked and waved at the small group of sign-waving picketers. Less than 24 hours before the company's announcement, the strikers seemed to know there was a strong possibility they'd lose this battle. But James Jones and his union brother Steve Blakey seemed optimistic anyway.
Well, you know what? Start all over. Do what we can do. We're not part of the 1%. You know, we're still part of the 99%. We can make it.
You know, I've always had a job, and I can find one. I can find one.
Hostess CEO Greg Rayburn told CNBC on Friday what he's been saying all along. The ongoing nationwide strike would drive the company out of business. Financial difficulties snowballed as Americans bought less Hostess product, and hedge fund investors needed to see a return on their investments. When asked if he might reconsider the decision to shut down the company, if the Bakers Union said it would immediately return to work, the Hostess CEO said no, it was, quote, too late. Laura Ziegler, KCUR News.
Thank you. Now that the season has ended for Sporting Kansas City, the question lingers on whether the soccer stadium at KCK will continue to carry on with the name as Livestrong Sporting Park. The Livestrong Foundation announced that Lance Armstrong is no longer on its board of directors. As KCUR's Greg Eklund reports, the top brass at Sporting was well aware of the controversy surrounding Armstrong when they chose to partner up with the foundation.
Last year, with Lance Armstrong present, Sporting Kansas City executives christened the KCK soccer stadium under construction.
I'd like to welcome everybody here today. My name is Rob Heinemann, and I'm the CEO of Sporting Club. And I guess I'd like to be the very first to welcome all of you to Livestrong Sporting Park.
Beyond the construction dust, it was a groundbreaking move. Until then, newly constructed sports facilities commonly displayed corporate titles, but you never heard about a charitable foundation attaching its name to a stadium. Sporting Kansas City promised to donate a portion of its revenue through ticket sales, concessions, and souvenir apparel to Livestrong. Again, Rob Heinemann.
I don't know what the average naming rights deal is in our league. It's probably a couple $1 million a year, $2.5-3 million a year. But that's not really the way that we looked at this. I mean, for us, like I said, we wanted to do something that helped define the community, allowed us the opportunity to drive social change, as you mentioned, and raise money in something that we absolutely believe in.
Armstrong, a cancer survivor, founded Livestrong in 1997 with fellow survivor Doug Ulmer, who was appointed the foundation's CEO. Armstrong that day was still under suspicion for the use of performance-enhancing drugs in the late 1990s and early 2000s. He talked, but strictly about Livestrong, not cycling.
You know, the one cool thing that we've always tried to do at the foundation is we've looked for different ways to tell our story. And in reality, it's all about us, me, Doug, any cancer survivor out there, a family member of a cancer survivor. It's about us sharing our story, and we've always encouraged people to do that.
Now, having been stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles by the International Cycling Union, Armstrong has severed his ties with the foundation. Previously, the Nike Corporation, which sponsored the distribution of yellow wristbands in support of the cause against cancer, cut its ties to Armstrong. But Heinemann has given no indication that Sporting Kansas City will prematurely end its association with Livestrong. Todd Palmer, the Sporting Kansas City beat reporter for the Kansas City Star, predicts the partnership will prevail.
They are not overly concerned about, you know, what Lance did or did not do during his cycling career. From their standpoint, it's a unique partnership where over the course of 5 years, they're giving $7.5 million to a charity to fight cancer. And that's always been their focus.
Lance Armstrong's image was displayed on the video board before each home game. Then a cancer survivor seated in the Livestrong yellow seat was introduced. Touching moments, but after the stripping of Armstrong's cycling titles, they became awkward. Sporting Kansas City are mum on their plans for the future of the stadium name. Greg Eklund, KCUR News.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. Immediately after the presidential election, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon announced the state would not be setting up its own health insurance exchange. Next door in Kansas, Sam Brownback made a similar announcement.
Exchanges are online marketplaces where people will soon go to compare and shop for health insurance. The federal health law requires all states have them up and running by January 1st of 2014 as part of the law's attempt to make health insurance more accessible.
Kansas and Missouri's recent decisions to stay out of it mean the federal government will likely come in and manage the exchanges instead. But as KCUR's Alana Gordon reports, how all of this will work remains elusive.
President Barack Obama's health law has never had an easy time in Kansas or Missouri, and it's still not going down very well. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback, a staunch opponent of the law, announced a few days after the election that Kansas would not have any involvement in setting up or managing a health exchange. Shireen Jones-Sontag is a spokesperson for Brownback's office.
Kansans feel Obamacare is an overreach by Washington and have rejected the state's participation in this federal program.
Across the state line in Missouri, the law has also faced an uphill battle. Voters approved a measure on Election Day that prohibits the governor or any state agency from making any moves towards setting up an exchange without legislative approval. And lawmakers don't convene again until January, well past some of the key deadlines for setting up an exchange. Governor Jay Nixon, a Democrat, has said all of this means that at least for now, Missouri will have a federal exchange.
Based on current state law and the federal deadline, the state-based option isn't on the table for Missouri at this time.
Some health policy experts find the situation in the region ironic. Thomas McAuliffe is with the Missouri Foundation for Health, which has helped fund efforts to plan an exchange.
We have a state that is very much committed to states' rights and state control, yet we're willing to just blindly cede all creation and administration of our health-based exchange or our insurance state marketplace to the federal government.
But McAuliffe doesn't want to write everything off just yet. He thinks states like Missouri are likely to become more involved in the process as the political dust settles. Governor Nixon himself said in his announcement that falling back on a federal exchange isn't ideal.
Regulating the insurance market is a power best left in the hands of the states, where we can perform those duties more efficiently and effectively and provide better service for our consumers.
Early on, Missouri had made some progress towards setting up an exchange, as had Kansas. That came to a halt in both states, and the governors were supposed to tell Health and Human Services by last week whether they or the federal government would be setting up and managing their exchanges. But the federal agency changed course the day before, giving states more time to submit their plans, and even more time to decide whether they'd want to partner with the federal government. Brownback has reaffirmed Kansas won't be involved, but there are still those like Kansas Insurance Commissioner Sandy Prager who want the state to have a role. Prager says that will depend on the path Governor Brownback takes with his new legislature in the months ahead.
His concern is that they have all these new conservative Republicans that won't want to go along with a partnership exchange. But I'm still hopeful. I'm still hopeful.
But lawmakers may bring up several concerns about getting involved. Frank Ellis is past chair of the Greater Kansas City Chamber of Commerce.
You can look at it from the standpoint of as state elected officials on both sides of the state line do not want to take on another liability, another bureaucracy, and they see that coming.
Ellis also heads SWOP Health Services, a community health center in the region that operates on both sides of the state line. He says patients, businesses, insurers, health providers, everyone has skin in the game, and he worries about a lack of state and regional involvement.
If the feds come in, they're not going to have a different model per se for each community. They're going to standardize one shoe fits all, and the health care needs in the state of Missouri and Kansas are far different than the health care needs in New York and Maine or are in Arizona.
Meanwhile, the Missouri Foundation for Health's Thomas McAuliffe says by extending the deadline for states to declare whether they will run an exchange or not, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services is signaling a bit of desperation.
This is an indication to me that Health and Human Services, i.e. the Obama administration, is dying for state support on this. Their worst-case scenario is that they set up nearly 30 federal-based exchanges.
And what that means, he says, is that states like Kansas and Missouri will still have an opportunity in the future to get more involved if they choose. But Missouri's Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder, who's supported legal challenges to the law, thinks these federal extensions are a sign of the health law's weakness and future demise.
They are effectively admitting failure. I do not believe the federal government is going to have the money to do the exchanges. And so the threat that they are leveling against us is that if we don't do a state-level exchange, they will do our exchange for us, and I'm prepared to call that bluff.
With the elections now behind them, leading Republican lawmakers in Missouri have started meeting again and discussing whether the state should get involved in an exchange. Kinder thinks the majority will want to stay out of it, but many still want more details from the federal government about how a state exchange would operate differently from a federal one. What the states decide to do down the road is not the chief concern for those in the healthcare industry like Matt All. All is the top lawyer with Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas, the largest company in the state. He says the reality is all of these exchanges have to be up and running in a little over a year.
I don't want to say it's going to be a rushed process, but we are going to have to work very intensely over the next several months to get ready. We just don't have time to spend worrying about the politics of it, to worry about regretting a decision or hoping for another decision. We just need to get started.
All says in order to get started, he and others need more direction from the feds on how the exchange will work now that they'll be taking the lead in the region. That includes getting more guidance on what the actual insurance products are supposed to look like to how they'll be sold on the exchange. And with a start date of January 1st, 2014, for when residents and small businesses will start accessing insurance on those exchanges, that's not a lot of time for either federal leaders or the healthcare industry to work out the details and make sure everything's ready. Reporting for KC Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
This story is part of a partnership with NPR, KCUR, and Kaiser Health News.
Still to come, a look inside the man-made disaster, the Dust Bowl. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
In 2009, Missouri passed a law that prohibits motorists 21 or younger from text messaging while driving. Yet, according to the National Highway Traffic Administration, there were close to 1,500 accidents in Missouri involving cell phones, resulting in 9 deaths.
Why do people, especially young people, continue to text and drive when they know it's dangerous? Are they actually addicted to texting? These are questions that intrigued KU psychology professor Paul Atchley in a study he conducted on texting and college students. Susan caught up with him recently to learn more.
So talk to us about the study. How did you structure the study to answer your questions?
So, you know, the term addiction is a really tough term to come to grips with because it means a lot of things to a lot of people. So we asked the question in a very simple way. How much would you be willing to give up in order to have the opportunity to text right now? When we think about addiction, we think that, you know, someone who's addicted to something, let's say alcohol, they would rather have, for example, one beer now than, you know, 2 cases of beer in a week because they need that right now. So in our study, we basically asked, you know, how much are you willing to give to have the opportunity to text right now?
And you used college students as your subjects. Why college students?
College students are great in this area because, one, you know, they're of that age demographic that have been using these devices for, you know, 10 or 12 years already. Two, they typically have the financial resources to have access to these devices, so they, you know, almost everyone on the college campus has a cell phone and they all use it to text. We found 97% of them text and drive. So this is a perfect group to study because they have the devices, they use the devices, and these devices are important to them.
So as I understand it, they were given some monetary incentives to delay texting. Is that it?
Right. I mean, we didn't actually give them real money. We used, you know, hypothetical money. Turns out that really doesn't matter. People have used both real money and hypothetical money. You get the same kind of effects. But the question is, if I say to you, okay, you have a text message coming in, you can take it right now and get this small monetary reward, or you can wait a little while and get a bigger monetary reward, which one do you choose? And if you're addicted, you're going to take that small monetary reward rather than that bigger one later.
What got you interested in this particular study?
Well, you know, I come from the safety side of things, trying to understand how we can improve safety by reducing distractions. And one question that always comes up is, well, are younger drivers just addicted to their phones, and is that going to make it difficult for us to change these kinds of behaviors?
Based on your results, has texting gone to an extreme?
Well, extremes, for me, I think it's an extreme. I mean, if we look at young adults today or teenagers today, they're just not interacting face-to-face. They're really choosing to interact mostly via text. In fact, even if someone's down the hallway, they would rather send a text than walk down the hallway and talk to them face-to-face.
So what did you find out? What were the results? Did they bear out your hypothesis?
Well, it is a really subtle set of effects, but, you know, to characterize it, I would say first, I don't think that we see people addicted to these devices. The kinds of decisions they were making look like typical sorts of decisions. They don't look any different than any other decision making. And when we think about texting, you know, people can choose not to text. For example, when we had people think about texting their girlfriends versus texting an acquaintance, someone they barely knew, they're always willing to put off texting the acquaintance. but they weren't going to put off texting their girlfriend. So they were able to make a rational decision, so they're not addicted. But what we did find is that if you are going to choose to text someone back, you have to make that decision to do it fairly quickly. If you wait, the information isn't as valuable. So we think people think these are addictive devices, not because people can't make choices about them, but simply because the choice has to be made fast. Yeah. So simply put, if I had someone make a decision just about taking a little bit of money now and a lot of money later, not worrying about texting, you know, they're typically going to be able to wait to get that bigger reward for a few weeks. If I have someone try to put off texting, they may only be able to put that decision off for about 25 minutes. So the rewards need to come in quickly. If they aren't quick, then the information loses value and there's just no point in texting back.
And I guess it begs the question that even though people know that it's unsafe, for example, to text and drive, they still have a compulsion to do it.
That's right. You know, in all the studies we've done where we ask people if they know distracted driving is unsafe, they say, oh, yeah, it's unsafe. It's very unsafe. They'll even tell us that a distracted driver in a crash is more responsible than a drunk driver in a crash. So they know how unsafe it is. The problem is that they still do it anyway. Understanding that is one thing we're really interested in. It's really critical for us.
Well, and actually, in terms of funding for your study, I was interested to see who the funder was in that regard. You want to talk about that?
Sure. I mean, this is something that was funded by the Transportation Research Institute at the University of Kansas, and they funded us to try to understand how to improve safety, and we felt that this would be an important component to really help us reach those young adults. We need to understand why they're doing it.
In terms of the implications of the study for the real world, how would you sum those up?
Well, I think for us, at least in traffic safety, you know, when we're looking at these devices, it tells me that we can reach younger adults and explain to them the risks. And if we can reach them in an effective way, even if they have access to those devices, they can make good decisions about whether or not to use them. If people were addicted to these devices, truly addicted to these devices, we would have a much more difficult time from a safety standpoint convincing them to not use the devices. If, on the other hand, it's just a compulsion, but they still have some control over it, then we may have an easier time changing behaviors and ultimately making the road safer.
So what are the logical next steps of a study like this in terms of trying to improve safety and within the issue of texting?
So for us right now, one of the things that we're doing with funding from the Kansas Department of Transportation is finding out what messages would actually work with this group to get them to put down the phones and just drive. So we're trying to do messaging campaigns. This is along with a collaborator, Ruger Genner, who's in the School of Journalism at KU, trying to figure out how to talk to people about this and how to convince them that, that they really should just hang up the phone and drive. So we know we can reach them. Now, how will we most effectively reach them?
So no early clues on what messages might be more effective yet, right?
Well, I think we have some clues, and I think the good news is that, you know, some of the things that we were able to do with drunk driving, as an example, in high schools and colleges will probably be similarly effective. For example, we had a crashed car, a car that was in a crash, from someone that was distracted while driving, a texting driver. And that, on the KU campus, was a very effective message for getting out the risk of distracted driving and get people to really think about it. So I think we've got some models that we've used before that may be effective. I think also texting is a social behavior. So what I tell people, and this is a good takeaway message, you know, texting and driving is about six times as bad as driving drunk. If you're texting someone while they're driving, you're the bartender in the back seat making them take shots of tequila while they're driving. If we can get people not only as drivers, but also as that other conversational participant to think about the circumstances in which they're texting another individual, that gives us another tool to help improve safety.
Paul Atchley is a psychology professor at KU. He recently conducted a study on texting and college students.
The Dust Bowl of the 1930s left an indelible mark on the Midwest and its history. That story is explored in a new documentary from Ken Burns airing this week on PBS. And as Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media reports, there could still be lessons to learn from this man-made disaster.
The Dust Bowl was an environmental catastrophe of biblical proportions. Swarms of grasshoppers blanketed the dry landscape. In some areas, herds of hungry jackrabbits scoured the land for any remaining vegetation. Neighbors formed extermination crews. A 1936 film from the Kansas Emergency Relief Commission explains the outcome.
Over 2 million jackrabbits were killed or captured in 13 counties in western Kansas.
But the enduring memory of the Dust Bowl is captured by the epic dust storms that smothered farms and cities. Exposed wheat fields were the source of the storms, fields plowed up in the 19-teens and 20s to take advantage of high prices and government programs. When the rain stopped in the 1930s, clouds of loose topsoil went airborne.
On the distant horizon appears the rolling curtain of dirt that will soon blot out all visibility.
Clouds, you know, you get these terrible dust storms, you can't even see the sun or anything. It'll just blow, and it'll blow fence lines under, just like snowdrifts and fence lines.
And the wind would whip that dust up, and you'd have to turn your lights on here in the middle of the afternoon. The dust was so thick you couldn't see across the street.
That's Arlo Hoppe, a farmer from Schuyler in eastern Nebraska, and Walter Baer, who lived in southeastern Colorado during the Dust Bowl, talking in interviews archived by the Nebraska State Historical Society. During this decade of near-constant drought, dust storms occurred throughout the Midwest and the Great Plains, but the storms were most severe in the Oklahoma Panhandle and surrounding portions of Kansas, Colorado, New Mexico, and Texas. Dayton Duncan co-produced the new PBS film, The Dust Bowl, with Ken Burns. He says farmers were buried by the same land that was supposed to make their living.
This is the soil that started to turn against you in ways that it killed your cattle, it ruined your crops.
Nearly 75 years later, that's a point worth remembering. As a single year, 2012 has been as dry as any in the 1930s. Michael Hayes, director of the National Drought Mitigation Center in Lincoln, Nebraska, says the 30s can happen again.
We've known this. We've looked back in the paleoclimate record, but the drought in the southern plains last year in 2011, and then the same thing happening in the central plains this year, made us think, hey, the weather conditions, the climate conditions like we had in the 1930s could actually happen again.
Farmers are not repeating the same mistakes. Modern cultivation keeps the land intact to protect it from the wind. Government conservation programs that started in the Dust Bowl still go on today. But farmers also continue to push the land. Today it's not a wheat boom like it was in the 1920s. It's a corn boom. The U.S. planted nearly 20 million more acres of corn this year than 20 years ago. With higher prices as a tailwind, North Dakota has nearly tripled its corn acres in a decade. Gene Tockley says farmers are able to grow more corn because of climate change. Tockley studies the effect of climate change on agriculture at Iowa State University. He says the trend points to a longer growing season and more rain on average.
Farmers are planting longer season hybrids. With this abundant rainfall, they're also planting higher populations. So we're planting corn populations now of 35,000 plants per acre, which was unheard of even 5 or 6 years ago.
And Tockley says with that opportunity comes volatility.
Average rainfall is going up, but the more important and more impactful side of that is that we're getting changes in the extremes. That is, the heavy rainfall events, and as we've seen this past year, significantly below normal precipitation.
Tockley says farmers need to prepare for more frequent droughts and floods, more unpredictable peaks and valleys in the climate. That's why documentary producer Dayton Duncan believes the Dust Bowl still stands as a cautionary tale.
The Dust Bowl isn't just about Mother Nature, it's about human nature. I think one of the lessons of the Dust Bowl is that any time that you forget to be humble in the face of the environment and nature, and any time you push the land too much, you're taking a great risk that in certain instances like the Dust Bowl can be catastrophic.
Whether a disaster like the Dust Bowl is ever repeated may have as much to do with how we manage ourselves as it does the weather. I'm Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration between KCUR and public media stations across the Midwest. You can see The Dust Bowl, a two-part documentary by Ken Burns, at 7 and 9 p.m. on PBS, November 18th and 19th. For more information, go to our website at kcur.org. www.greenpeace.org. In times of natural disaster, we tend to see the best of humankind, but sometimes we also see the worst. After the 2011 Joplin tornado, some scam artists posed as charities, and that's happening again on the East Coast in response to Hurricane Sandy. KSMU's Jennifer Davidson has safety tips to consider when donating to a charity.
Let's start with the red flags. According to the Missouri Department of Public Safety, you should be wary of so-called charities that tell you you've won a prize, ask you to forward soliciting information onto your friends, use high-pressure tactics, have names that sound very similar to reputable charities, and have poorly constructed websites. Some charity scam artists claim to hold fundraisers for police and fire departments, promising the donors they will receive special treatment in return for a contribution. If you see any of these tactics, watch out. Here's what you can do to prevent charity fraud. Again, according to the Missouri Department of Public Safety, request written information about the organization, including the full address and phone number. Check it out with the Better Business Bureau or the charity watchdog group CharityNavigator.org. Don't be pressured to donate on the spot, and give directly to the charity whenever possible. Jeff Neeney works for the humanitarian organization Convoy of Hope, which has 4 stars on CharityNavigator.org. It's also part of the Better Business Bureau's Wise Giving Alliance. Neeney suggests that if you're going to give to a charity, do your homework, which includes talking to friends and family members about an organization before you give. Another thing to research, he says, is efficiency.
One of the primary factors is how efficient are they with your dollar? When you give a dollar, is 10 cents going to the victims or is 90 cents going to the victims?
Neeney says every charity has overhead, salaries, supplies, fundraising, and program costs. But Convoy of Hope usually keeps its overhead under 10% of its budget. Right now, much of that other 90% is going to food, water, blankets, and cleaning supplies for victims of Hurricane Sandy in New York and New Jersey. For KSMU News, I'm Jennifer Davidson.
If you missed part of Casey Kearns today, you can listen to individual stories or hear the show online at kcur.org, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
Coming up, a Navajo code talker is honored locally. This is Casey Kearns.
This is Casey Kearns. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. In area news this week, a prayer group leader was accused of having his wife killed. Phil Klein defended his law license, and the federal government announced it would create 800 jobs here. KCUR's Steve Bell looks back on those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
U.S. Immigration Service spokesman Tim Counts said on Tuesday that the agency will bring 500 jobs to Overland Park, 300 to Lee's Summit, but not all at once.
It will be more of a slow rollout of the job announcements.
Counts credits President Obama's order allowing some young undocumented immigrants to stay in the United States if they were brought here as children. The Bakers Union at the Wonder Bread plant in Lenexa led off a strike against the Hostess Company, which at one time was headquartered here. Out on the picket lines, they said the company insisted on big cuts to wages and benefits.
No way. We would not take the concessions. I can't live off the wages they're going to pay us. No.
Hostess delivered an ultimatum. Back to work by Thursday night or we sell the company to the highest bidder. Spokesman Lance Inyon said,
if strikers think that this is a nifty way to bring in a new employer who presumably would give them better pay and wages, I think that's a dangerous proposition.
The union didn't go back to work, and on Friday, Hostess told a bankruptcy court it will liquidate and look for a buyer. Ambulance response times that didn't meet city standards, especially in the Northland, prompted the Kansas City City Council to tell the city manager and the fire department to get the problems fixed.
We aren't saying
do it this way or do it that way. We aren't saying go back to the old way of dispatching. We're simply saying let's decrease the time it takes to dispatch an ambulance.
Councilman John Sharp, who says next the council will set up an advisory board including an emergency medical expert and council members for the ambulance service. Former Kansas Attorney General Phil Klein defended his law license before the state Supreme Court and told reporters,
"My office acted with integrity and with full compliance with ethical rules and the rules of law, and endeavored to be forthright at every instance."
The ethics charges against Klein stemmed from his investigations of abortion providers. Klein said he was singled out for political reasons, but State Disciplinary Administrator Stan Hazlett said,
"I just want to make this clear. This type of conduct found by the panel would have been prosecuted by our office no matter who the prosecutor was, no matter who the defendants were in the criminal case."
The court didn't say when it might hand down its decision. An already controversial South Kansas City religious group found itself in the midst of a bizarre murder case. Prosecutors said Tyler Deaton, a volunteer functionary at the International House of Prayer, put out the hit order on his wife because he feared she would expose a sexual group involved in acts of abuse. Another prayer group member was charged with killing Bethany Deaton and trying to make it look like suicide. The week's Kansas education controversy centered on curriculum. The State Board of Education pondered the teaching of cursive writing. Some people consider it outdated in the computer tablet age. Member Janet Waugh said older constituents still favor it.
Grandparents talked with me about this regarding how they noticed that their grandchildren could not write. You know, I mean, they simply couldn't write cursive.
It looked like cursive writing would stay, but science was slipping because of the emphasis on test scores in reading and math. A study showed more than half of Kansas teachers reporting less time spent on science, and 5% said they gave science grades, though science was not taught. This is KCUR.
For the past several years, the numbers of non-traditional college students have been increasing. But last Monday, as part of the Veterans Day observance, the University of Kansas awarded a degree to one of its least traditional graduates ever, a 91-year-old former Navajo code talker. Alex Smith has this story.
Oh, say can you see?
A sunny conference room at KU's Lead Center building couldn't contain the crowd of nearly 300 who turned out Monday morning to see Navajo code talker Chester Nez. After the Star-Spangled Banner, a former Haskell student started the ceremony with a prayer using both the English and Navajo languages. Kansas First Lady Mary Brownback offered a welcome, and Lawrence's mayor offered a key to the city while Chester Nez grinned and nodded from his wheelchair. And when KU Dean Danny Anderson handed Nez an honorary diploma for a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree, the crowd, which included many American Indians and veterans, jumped to its feet to applaud. Chester Nez then took the mic and briefly thanked the school and the audience.
Hello, everybody. I'd like to say that it's a great pleasure for me to come back to the University of Kansas. I am so happy to be here, and I want to thank everybody that's here.
If things had gone according to plan, Chester Nez would have received this degree about 60 years ago. In 1952, he was studying painting at KU when his World War II and Korea-era GI education benefits ran out. So he returned to his home state of New Mexico, where he started a job and settled into a quiet family life. But his son Michael explains that in the late 60s, when the military details were declassified, Chester was finally able to tell his family that he had been a code talker.
In 1968, he had us come into the living room and he told us, he said, "This is actually what I did." But we didn't understand exactly how important it was at the time. It wasn't until Vietnam when I really saw the full extent of what and how important communications they did.
In 1942, the Marines recruited 29 Navajos to convey secret messages in the Pacific War. The Navajo language was so complex and unfamiliar that the Japanese military was never able to decipher the messages. Chester Nez was one of the original 29 of the all-Navajo 382nd Marine Platoon, which eventually had about 420 members. But as important as the Navajo language was to Chester Nez, he never taught it to his children. Michael Nez explains.
I speak very little. I was raised in Albuquerque all my life, so not very many Navajos to converse with. And I asked Mom, why didn't you guys didn't teach us Navajo? And they said, we thought you would do better in school. That's because after finding out how they treated them when they were going to school, because they weren't allowed to speak their language when they went to school.
Many of the Code Talkers became celebrities, frequently appearing in veterans' events and in parades. But Michael says his father mostly kept quiet and avoided the public spotlight. That was until 2002, when a major motion picture about Code Talkers came out.
He didn't really step forward until MGM came out with the movie Wind Talkers, because, of course, they contacted us. Dad did news junkets for them, and we traveled from Hollywood to Washington, D.C., to New York, and then back to Hollywood for the premiere at the Chinese Theater. But, he's pretty open about it now. I mean, he won't go as far as telling some of the gory stuff, because he still doesn't, it does bother him to talk about it. But things that he went, places he's been, things that he did out there, he'll talk about some of that, but not a whole lot.
Today, Chester Nez is the last surviving member of the original 29 Navajo Code Talkers. Over the years, he's received countless awards, including the Congressional Gold Medal. But his son says Nez will value his diploma among his highest honors.
To be honest, dude, this is up there with him receiving the gold medal. It really is. I mean, I myself, when they presented him with his diploma, I was pretty emotional. It means a lot to us. And I know to him, I could see it when he was looking at the diploma.
Today, Chester Nez lives in Albuquerque with his extended family. Last year, his autobiography, Code Talker, was released. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
It's fitting that the first career retrospective for photographer Terry Evans takes place in her hometown of Kansas City, Missouri, at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, where she took classes as a child.
For decades, Evan has documented the Midwest prairie, its people and artifacts, and more recently she's explored her new hometown of Chicago, the oil and gas industries, always examining the relationship between the people and the land. Evans told KCUR's Laura Spencer that it was in Lawrence, where she studied painting and drawing at the University of Kansas, that she first started taking photographs.
In 1968, Bobby Kennedy came to Kansas to kick off his presidential campaign. That was in March. And first he went to K-State, and then he came to KU, where I was. So I borrowed this Nikon from my father and went down on the floor of the field house. And it was such an amazing experience to be right there at the interface of something that was happening in the world and making pictures. I liked the idea of being able to use what I had learned in art in photography. I like the idea that photography is an interface with the world.
And many of your works that show people, they're not famous people. They're everyday people, and often they're Kansans working on the land. Or in some of your early black and white photographs, there's a wonderful picture called Kansas City, Kansas, 1973, with a woman with her son who's sleeping in her lap.
I've always been interested in photographing people in their own environment, telling those stories of the interweaving of people and their surroundings.
I read it was in 1978 when you were living in Salina that you were first asked to photograph the prairie, and that experience really shaped and directed your work for the next three decades. Could you talk a little bit about when you first started taking photographs of the prairie and what that experience was like for you?
Well, I never thought that I wanted to photograph landscape. I was so interested in photographing people and learning their stories. And then one day, Wes Jackson of the Land Institute asked me to photographically record some survey work he was doing on a nearby virgin prairie near Salina, Kansas, where I lived. And so in looking at the ground in the spring and in watching the prairie grow, I started seeing so many patterns and so much life there, such diversity and complexity of plants. It suddenly became extremely interesting to me, and I spent the next year and a half going back to that 80-acre piece of virgin prairie and photographing it at all times of the year, trying to understand the patterns of biological growth and what they meant, because they also seemed very symbolic to me. It seemed that if I could understand the structure and growth on the prairie, then I could understand the whole universe.
In some of these prairie photographs, you have these detailed close-up images of the grassland. But in 1980, you started working with aerial photography. And there's one series in the exhibition, Photographs of Chicago, where you were up in a helicopter, a hot air balloon, and also in a small airplane. How did you start doing aerial photography?
I really wanted to know if the prairie looked the same from above as it did below. When I was learning about the prairie, I was reading everything, even everything from grass systematics to history of how the Plains Indians had used medicinal plants. But one thing I read was a book about medieval spirituality, and there was the phrase, as above, so below. And I began to wonder about that in relationship to the prairie. And once I did make my earliest aerial photo flights, I was so amazed because I could see all the relationships on the ground. You know, one can't help but see the connectedness of everything from that aerial perspective.
What the aerial perspective provides, too, in some of your works, you can really see the juxtaposition of untouched land and land that has been manipulated by humans. I guess the Canada-U.S. border picture is kind of like that, too, where it looks very one side not touched, but the other side very structured and lined out.
Yes, that Canada-U.S. picture is so fascinating to me. It's actually kind of amusing because it is the border between Canada and the U.S., but it's not an ecological border. It's a political border. You can actually see it. You know, often we can't see the borders. We wouldn't recognize the border between Kansas and Missouri from the air, but we can actually see this political border because on the U.S. side it was farmed and on the Canadian side it was not. You can't go very far without seeing it flipped, you know, farmed on the Canadian side, not on the U.S. side.
Well, it's interesting you brought up the word political because in some of the text around your photographs, more recent photographs, including the North Dakota oil boom, it was described as you had been previously neutral in some of your photography, but now you're taking a more strong political viewpoint. And do you feel like before you were documenting and now you're taking more of a stand on certain environmental issues?
I've never really felt like I was neutral. I have felt like my job as an artist is to tell the stories of the prairie. That's what I feel most compelled to do.
Photographer Terry Evans spoke with KCUR's Laura Spencer. The exhibition, Heartland, The Photographs of Terry Evans, continues through January 20th at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Find out more at kcur.org. I want to thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents.
Casey Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our intern. And our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.